Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. This week, we are taking you to the recent 32nd Annual Camden Conference at the Camden Opera House for a series of talks surrounding this year's theme, Is This China's Century? Today, we will hear from Elizabeth Economy discussing the Xi Vision and from Robert Daly presenting U.S.-China Relations, A New Era in Need of New Ideas. Elizabeth Economy is a CV Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Robert Daly is the Director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time and will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Here is the first speaker of today's program, Elizabeth Economy.
I'm going to pile on and offer my own sort of framework for understanding China, hopefully bringing together some of the threads of the past evening and day and linking a little bit the domestic and the foreign policy. If there's any time at the end, I'll also try to provide a little bit of a bridge to Robert's remarks on the U.S.-China bilateral relationship, but my guess is we won't have enough time for that. So let me just start by taking you back to the 19th Party Congress in October of 2017, when Xi Jinping was reselected for his second term as General Secretary of the Communist Party. And in his acceptance speech, about halfway through, it was a 3.5-hour speech, he uttered the phrase, China has stood up, grown rich, become strong. And a little bit later in the speech, he said, and is moving towards center stage. And that phrase, almost more than anything else that I have encountered, really, I think, helps encapsulate the evolution of China's political ambitions, as well as how Xi Jinping sees his own tenure within the context of recent sort of contemporary Chinese political history. So, the first period, or what I term the first revolution, and China stood up, was, of course, Mao Zedong standing up against the Japanese invaders, but also Mao and the Communist Party standing up against the ruling party of the time, the Kuomintang, and creating the contemporary Chinese Communist Party state in 1949. If you fast forward then again to 1979, you have the entrance of Deng Xiaoping. This is the period of China growing rich, period of reform and opening up. As Ang Yuanyuan mentioned yesterday, Deng Xiaoping really undertook some significant shifts, right? He moved China away from the single man authoritarian form of leadership to a more consensus and collective based decision-making process. He also introduced the market into China, the Chinese economy, and also began the process of allowing civil society to flourish, the beginning of China's civil society and non-governmental organizations really in the mid-1990s. And he welcomed ideas, foreign influences, both in terms of foreign capital, but also foreign non-governmental organizations began to be established in China. And of course, very famously, he maintained a low-profile foreign policy. He wanted to focus on developing China at home, didn't want to be distracted by external events or external problems. So that was what Deng himself termed China's second revolution, that period of 30 years, a little bit more, that he ushered in, until 2012. And I do believe, although some things that we've seen under Xi Jinping emerged slightly prior to the advent of his leadership, I do believe that he has been the third transformative leader in China, beginning with Mao. And in many respects, this is the period, of course, where China becomes strong and moves towards center stage. I think Xi Jinping has upended much of what we've come to understand as the China model, as that model of reform and opening up, to begin to create his own model of Chinese politics. So what I want to do is just describe for you what I see as sort of the four most important structural shifts underway in China today, things that have taken place really over the past 6 years. The first is a shift away from that consensus and collective-based decision-making process back to a more single-man authoritarian form of rule. Xi Jinping has amassed an enormous amount of institutional power in his own hands. He sits on top of most of the important committees and commissions that oversee broad swaths of Chinese policy, whether we're talking about reform and you know, the deepening of economic reform, or Taiwan policy, or national security, cyber. Xi Jinping is in charge of all of these commissions and committees. He has also launched a massive anti-corruption campaign, which has gotten a lot of attention here in the United States in the media. I think what distinguishes his campaign from others, because it's not new, anti-corruption campaigns have been a staple of Chinese political life dating back centuries, and Mao launched his first campaign in the early 1950s, right after he took power. But what has distinguished it is just the robust nature of it, the fact that every year more Chinese officials are disciplined than the year before. I think many of us expected that it would be a very typical campaign. It would start up and then it would sort of wax and wane. After a few years, it would kind of die off. But last year in 2018, some 623,000 officials were disciplined, right? That's 100,000 more than the year before. So he has only increased the intensity of this campaign. Some people ask, you know, is the campaign a real anti-corruption campaign, or is it really just targeted against his political enemies? I mean, of course, it's a real campaign. He doesn't have 627,000 or 623,000 political enemies. But certainly, there is an element of the campaign that has been targeted at political competitors. And there was a study that was done by a professor who's now up at Harvard in the early years of the campaign that demonstrated that about 40% of the officials who were at the vice ministerial level or above, which is a pretty high level, were in some way connected, right, some way tied into Xi's political competitors. So definitely an element of removing his political competition. And of course, as you heard yesterday, he has also deinstitutionalized the succession process. He failed to signal a successor for himself as general secretary in the next round in 2022, which he was expected to do in 2017 at the 19th Party Congress. And of course, he abolished the two-term limit for the presidency that Deng Xiaoping had put in place in the early 1990s. So this allows him to hold the three most important positions, at least for, you know, obviously for this 5 years, for the next 5 years or beyond, really until the Communist Party and he decide that he should no longer hold it. So that's the first thing he's done, is really moved away from that consensus collective-based decision-making process to control much more power in his own hands. The second thing I think that he's done is really to reassert the power of the Chinese Communist Party back into the everyday life of the Chinese people and the Chinese economy in a way that, you know, during Deng Xiaoping's period, he really withdrew the party. But Xi has really reasserted the power of the party. The party is very important to him. The anti-corruption campaign is one element of this, but also just the party at the forefront of the political system and reasserting that has been important. How has that manifested? I think a couple of different ways. We could look at the surveillance system that China has put in place. Somewhere between, the numbers range from 176 million to 200 million cameras that are capable of facial recognition, but also moving toward voice recognition and gait recognition so that you can identify people by how they walk. Right? So really extraordinary, and the number that's posted out there of the number of cameras that they want to have to roll out in the next year or so is up to 600 million cameras. Imagine that. I think if you want to understand the sort of the excesses to which this can be taken, you could look at Xinjiang Autonomous Region in the far western part of the country, which has been transformed, I think, into nothing less than a police state at this point, right, with the Uyghurs. And it's a combination, it's a really a fascinating and terrible combination of traditional forms of Chinese political repression, right, sending teams of Communist Party officials into the homes of the Uyghurs to live there and to monitor them and to inculcate them and to make sure that they're not, you know, maintaining beards and headscarves and practicing religion, with the high-tech capabilities of the country now, with all of the cameras and biometrics, and recently, of course, there were articles about the DNA. taking of the Uyghurs, and of course the re-education camps, right, of which we hear there are as many as a million Uyghurs in these re-education and to some extent forced labor camps. So I think that is the sort of excess element of this sort of party intrusion into the life of the people. There's also the social credit system. A lot has been written about this in the U.S. media. I would simply say it's an interesting idea, right? Evaluating the trustworthiness, the political and economic trustworthiness of citizens, and then rewarding or punishing them accordingly. There is no national system at this point. It's, I think, about 40 pilot projects, and even when it becomes national so that every Chinese citizen is registered in one form or another by 2020, it still won't be one program across the entire country. I will say that when I was doing interviews for the book that I wrote, I interviewed 15, just off the cuff, sort of 15 young people who worked in 3Q, which is a kind of WeWork thing, a beautiful space. They have a number of them. Soho Real Estate makes them, and so they're sort of shared working spaces. And so I just walked around and asked 15 random people, mostly in their 20s and 30s, what do you think about this social credit system? And a couple, two of them didn't know what I was talking about, but most of them were actually pretty positive about it. And one person said, you know, there's not a lot of trust in Chinese society outside the family, outside an immediate circle of friends, and this will help us understand whom to trust. And it was just a good reminder to me of the importance of political culture, that what we take as, you know, sort of dominant or primary values might not be shared everywhere else. I think as the social credit system evolves, as all the metrics are determined, you know, is it going to be how many hours of video games are you playing, or is it going to be, you know, not only are you participating in a protest, but is your friend participating in your protest, right? Because if your friend is, that will affect your score negatively as well. There are lots of different things that are being tested out. It may emerge that many more Chinese are not particularly happy with what's happening. A lot of the public shaming, putting people's faces on billboards. It's, again, this kind of fascinating combination of traditional sort of Maoist, techniques with the sort of sophistication of technology. And then I think on the economic front, you could look at the sort of growing role of the party in Xi's effort to enhance the role of party committees in not only state enterprises, but also private enterprises and joint ventures. And, you know, typically, so now I think the number is about 70% of all private enterprises and joint ventures have party committees. And party committees are simply committees that are made up of party members who are working in any individual company. And, you know, in recent past, I think most of them didn't really do much, right? You might meet, you might discuss recent laws and regulations, you might read through Xi Jinping's speech and talk about it, you might be the group that is responsible for some good social, you know, initiative, you know, a tree planting campaign in the older days, but you really didn't play a significant role in the leadership of the company. But what Xi Jinping is looking to do is to have that party committee play a more important role in the economic decision making of these companies, right? So to have the chair of the party committee become the chairman of the board of the company. And so I was talking to a person who's in charge of a large German multinational who's in charge of the company in China for the China operations, and he said that the party committee had tried to tell them where to invest, and they pushed back and said no, and they were successful in saying no. But you get the idea that Xi Jinping is really trying to extend the reach of the party, right? State-owned enterprises are extensions of the party, of course, do have to respond very directly to the party's demands. But now to extend that power and that influence to make these companies kind of arms of Chinese government interest and influence. So a pretty significant shift from the Deng era of trying to enhance the role of the market. The third sort of big shift I see is the creation of what I call a virtual wall of restrictions and regulations that allow the Chinese leadership to control more closely what comes in and what goes out of the country. So the internet would be the prime example of this, but I think there are others that are perhaps less familiar. For example, the law on the management of foreign NGOs. And that came into force in January of 2017. And foreign NGOs, as I think Ma Jun was saying, you saw his partnership for some of his projects with NRDC.
which of course is a US-based environmental NGO, have played a really important role in the development of civil society in China through partnerships, through education. I remember in the very early stages of the environmental NGO movement in China that the National Committee on US-China Relations and others used to bring some activists, I don't know whether Ma Jun, you were part of that, but would bring them here to the United States for some training. Some of them would be placed in a US NGO for a period of 3 months to learn how they operate. Foreign foundations have played a really important role in funding civil society development in China. So by the time, 2016, there were upwards of 7,000 foreign NGOs, and certainly not all US NGOs, from many, many different countries, US NGOs who were actively engaged, who were actively engaged in a wide range of efforts working with their partners in China on the environment, on healthcare, on poverty alleviation, on education of migrant children. But when the law came into force, right, it moved control for these NGOs, for these foreign NGOs, from the Ministry of Civil Society to the Ministry of Public Security. It put in place very onerous registration requirements. And you saw the number now that have been formally registered to operate, right? So this is now 2 years on, is somewhere just slightly above 400. So we've gone from 7,000, more than 7,000, to slightly above 400. And this has had enormous ramifications for many NGOs, not for the big and frontline NGOs like Ma Jun's, obviously very celebrated in China for their work, well known, but for many other much smaller NGOs with less capacity, the loss of that connection with foreign NGOs has been quite significant for their future work. Made in China 2025, I think, is also a good example on the economic front. Made in China 2025 is, as far as I can tell, is basically about protecting Chinese firms from real competition with multinationals across 10 areas of cutting-edge technology, right? Everything from artificial intelligence to new energy vehicles to medical devices. And how is this playing out? Even though the Chinese have now, in the face of President Trump's, efforts, have now taken the name off of Made in China 2025, so there is no more Made in China 2025, of course there is still Made in China 2025. It just doesn't have the name anymore, but it did allow President Trump to declare victory around that. And so you say they stopped it because I didn't like it, but it's still there, of course. How does it actually operate? Let me give you one example. The Financial Times did a great piece on this maybe a year and a half ago, where they looked at medical devices, and they found that Fujian province had put in place a new regulation that said hospitals could not be reimbursed, right, for operations or treatment that used 15 different medical devices unless they used Chinese-made medical devices. Right? So that's the kind of, you heard a little bit about, up here is Beijing, and you give a directive, and how that is actually implemented or developed at the local level may vary from one place to another. But that's the kind of really creative, right, restriction or regulation or law that can come into place to try to fulfill a Made in China 2025 directive. And that's what will make it so very difficult as the trade talks continue, actually, to get at this issue, because it's not going to be simply Beijing saying, oh, we finished this program or effort. It's going to be really looking at the local level and all the myriad ways in which it actually could be implemented to try to get it at those as well. And then finally, the fourth structural shift is the move, and I think most noticeable to people outside China, is the move from a low-profile foreign policy to a far more ambitious and expansive foreign policy. And I think it's evident at sort of three different levels. The first is around issues of Chinese sovereignty. So one of the things that Xi Jinping has focused on has been his desire to, reunify China, right? To unify China, and that includes the South China Sea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong and Macau. And you can see that in his first term, he has made certainly significant progress in the South China Sea, where he has militarized seven artificial features. despite telling President Obama that he would not militarize any of these artificial features. In terms of Hong Kong, definitely increased political repression, no matter how far Beijing is from Hong Kong. We've definitely seen efforts to curtail political expression in Hong Kong. And in Taiwan, with the election of Tsai Ing-wen 2 years ago, which is, you know, she represents the DPP, which is the pro-independence party, although she hasn't moved toward any sort of announcement of independence at all, has been extremely moderate. Xi Jinping has undertaken a number of both coercive measures, but also some inducements. So we've seen, for example, that they've called, you know, for a significant drop in mainland Chinese tourists to Taiwan, in an effort to kind of put pressure on the Taiwanese economy. They have, Xi Jinping has cut off all of the bilateral discussions between Taiwan and the mainland, so they've had no, sort of, they have a semi-formal dialogue that has been going on, and he cut that off. He's offered some inducements to Taiwanese businesses to relocate to the mainland by telling them they would receive national treatment, get all the benefits of a, you know, Chinese mainland company. And certainly for Taiwanese students, there's interest in going to study in the mainland as well. But there's a sort of a chill, and I should say he's also reintroduced sort of an effort that had been underway up until Ma Ying-jeou, the previous Taiwanese president, was in office, who was viewed as more favorably inclined toward the mainland, of sort of buying off the few countries that still recognize Taiwan diplomatically. And I think it's gone from 22 to 17 at this point in terms of countries that recognize Taiwan. So anyway, and there's some efforts on the military side as well. So a number of efforts to try to squeeze Taiwan to sort of limit its international space and to maneuver. So I think that's, and he has called for sort of reunification by 2049. That's his soft target date. The second is the Belt and Road Initiative. And I know that this was discussed in previous remarks, sets of remarks. Let me just add a little bit. I think the initial impetus, and Xi Jinping sort of outlined Belt and Road back in 2013 two speeches, the first in Xinjiang and the second, first in Kazakhstan and the second in Indonesia. I think the initial impetus for this was, yes, in part, to contribute to the very dramatic needs for infrastructure developed globally, but also to export Chinese overcapacity, right, in a lot of the sort of heavy industries, because China didn't have as much need for infrastructure development within its own boundaries, and also to link some of the lesser developed parts of the country to external markets. So there wasn't, it wasn't, you know, just sort of this beneficent program. There was definitely some very significant self-interest that also drove this. In terms of its actual impact, I think it certainly has had impact, but probably not as much as many people imagine. So if you look at the levels of investment, actually, in Belt and Road countries relative to Chinese overseas investment elsewhere, up until last year, so not including 2018, Belt and Road countries only received about 12% of Chinese overseas investment. The vast majority came to the United States and Europe. Right. So we just want to keep this a little bit in perspective. So the big, you know, announcement out there is all about Belt and Road, but actually in terms of investment, it's actually a very small percentage. There is a lot of lending that goes out to Belt and Road countries. And the final point I'll make in terms of the investment is, you know, it's tempting, because this is the way that the media describes it a lot, to think that, you know, China is the largest source of investment everywhere. In fact, if you look, you know who the largest source of investment in Africa is? Any guess? Last year, it's the United States, right? The United States by quite a significant amount. Largest source of investment in Southeast Asia is the European Union, right? Followed by Japan. And then it alternates between China and the United States 1 year and the next year. So it bears looking beyond the headlines to actually what's taking place on the ground to understand sort of the relative impact and what's actually transpiring. You know, we don't have, in the United States, Japan, the EU, our presidents don't go out as much and say, we're going to be investing all of this, because we don't have the capacity to do that. We don't have firms at our disposal that we know will go out and invest $50 or $60 billion. But actually what the private enterprises do from many of these places is actually even more significant. I also think what's interesting about the Belt and Road is that it's evolved and it's morphed. And there's a tendency to think that it's this sort of big, giant, well-conceived and articulated plan from Xi Jinping at the outset, but that's not at all what it has been. It began as a heavy infrastructure, as an infrastructure project, ports, railroads, highways. It's evolved into then a digital Belt and Road to include e-commerce and fiber optic cables and satellite systems. There is a security component to it, right? So China now, I think it is up to 50 ports, in maybe more than 80 countries, has either outright ownership or a controlling stake in 50 ports. And even though it says that these ports are for commercial purposes, we've seen that PLA Navy ships have stopped by many of these ports in the recent past. And I will say, when I was in Beijing a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, I was at a security conference and asked a couple of the military people who were there, like, how many bases do you think you want, right? And they said, 100 or more. And I don't know whether they really want 100 or more, but I think, we would be foolish, right, not to understand that as China's economy has expanded, as its political interests have expanded, its security interests are expanding along with that. And as I think Wu Xinbo said, it's a natural evolution. But that old sort of idea that China would never have bases, which was something that they said all the way up through recent past, I think is certainly no longer the case. And then I would also say that there's become a political element within the Belt and Road, and that a number of countries now, I think it's up to 16, have adopted China's surveillance system, right? Peru, Bolivia is looking at it, a number of countries in Africa. Chinese officials are in Tanzania training the officials there on how to manage the internet and political dissent. And so I think in civil society. So I think, this is not something China intended from the outset, but as opportunities have emerged, the Chinese have been, I think, very good about taking advantage of those opportunities. And then finally, I would say the third area, if you have the sovereignty issue and then Belt and Road, I think the third area, and one that I don't think has been discussed this far, is the issue of global norms and institutions. Actually, it was discussed a little bit. And is China looking to reform those norms? Is it looking to upend those institutions? And I think it's a combination, and it just depends. I think, as Wu Xinbo pointed out, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank operates according to global standards, the same standards of the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. In fact, its charter was written by a former World Bank, an American, a former World Bank legal counsel. So it very much adheres to those norms. Are there other norms around human rights that China's trying to shape in the United Nations in different ways? Absolutely. Is China bringing a different voice from that of the United States and some other countries in terms of internet governance? Absolutely. I think the important thing when we're talking about China and the sort of global system is to be very careful to look at, where is China basically just putting up additive, institutions and ideas like the AIB? Where is it seeking to change things in ways that are maybe make things better, right? Reform within the voting rights of the International Monetary Fund, and where is it doing things that perhaps are antithetical to our interests and values, maybe on human rights, where we really need to push back? So I have 1.5 minutes. Let me just maybe provide a tiny bridge to Robert and say, I know in Martin's initial comments, he said, it's the U.S. has changed, right? The U.S.-China relationship has changed because U.S. policy has changed. So let me just offer a counter perspective, drawing on my good friend Wang Jisi, who I think many of you know is one of China's premier scholars of the U.S.-China relationship. And he said in a recent interview that, the U.S. has caused problems for us for, 200 years around a whole range of issues, and we've pushed back, as we should have. But if you want to understand why U.S. policy has changed now, it's because China's policy has changed, right? And so I think no matter that certainly the Trump administration has introduced a number of new elements into both U.S. foreign policy more broadly and also into the U.S.-China relationship, much of what has transpired in the past few years in terms of the bilateral relationship between the United States and China has to do with the changes that have come under Xi Jinping and the recognition in the United States that this is a very different China. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program features two Camden Conference speakers. Here is the second speaker, Robert Daly, presenting U.S.-China Relations, A New Era in Need of New Ideas.
The British critic Quentin Crisp, he said, "Kids today are violent because they have no inner life. They have no inner life because they have no thoughts. They have no thoughts because they know no words. They know no words because they never speak, and they never speak because the music is too loud." Sorry, Kaiser. In Washington, I feel like the music is often too loud around U.S.-China relations, and it tends increasingly toward anger and vitriol and defensiveness. And that's one of the reasons that there's a tendency perhaps toward violence and a lack of inner life. In some quarters in Washington, and I get to travel all over the country, and I tend to find, as I found here in Maine, that you have a very different set of views that are more moderate, more balanced, a little less political, a little bit more humanistic, and it's very refreshing. I think what we need to do now is to bring these two dialogues together, the Washington security concerns, with the broader, more humanistic views we find throughout the United States. We've heard a lot of speakers point out correctly that there are people, especially in Washington, who have this cartoon critique of engagement. You know, that it was about making China more like us, they're not like us, therefore the engagement has failed. And there are people who oppose engagement who have this kind of cartooned version of that. But there's also a bit of a cartooned critique of concerns about U.S.-China relations as well that is a little bit too quick to dismiss them. And so I want to try to bring those together. And so it falls to me today at the end of this conference, which I think has been very broad and very balanced, it falls to me to be a little bit of the heavy, which is not the role I usually play. In D.C. circles, I'm sort of the culture guy who's suspected of being kind of limp-wristed and not sufficiently concerned about hypersonic glide reentry vehicles. But here I'm going to be the heavy, and I'm increasingly cast in this. You know, I've been in Washington long enough. I was in Burlington last summer to give a talk to the APLU, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. And I was walking up to from the waterfront in the morning to the University of Vermont for the talk, and I was dressed like this. I was overdressed and very hot, and so I went into a Vermont coffee shop in the morning. It was called Uncommon Grounds. It's one of these virtue coffee shops that you find throughout New England, and it's shade grown, and it's fair trade, and it's usually not very good, and it's very expensive. Virtue coffee is very expensive. And so I bought this cup of coffee, and I was the only person dressed like this. Everybody else was in cutoffs and flip-flops, and I felt like I was getting the stink eye from everybody, and I sat down, and they seemed to sort of move away. And then my wife called, and I was sort of in a hushed voice telling her about this. I said, "Everybody here seems to be looking at me like I'm the SOB from Washington. I've got an entire drawer full of tie-dye t-shirts. But you know, has this happened? Am I the son of a bitch from Washington?" And my wife said, "Well, of course, you're not originally from Washington." So one of those thanks, honey moments. So I want to start by talking about this question that they've lured us all in here with, but that nobody has really addressed. Is this China's century? And of course, this is going to depend on definitions. And there's one sense in which I think the answer is almost certainly a resounding yes. And the answer is yes, in that I'm fairly sure that for the vast majority of Chinese, this will be the best century in history in which to be Chinese. By almost any measure, including the range of the exercise of personal freedom, that most Chinese people have in their daily lives. And anybody who got there in the 80s or early 90s will see the difference. And so this is a tremendous human achievement that has to be recognized and celebrated. And as we get more concerned about China's rise, I think we have to remember, and this is often forgotten in Washington, that China's rise in the main is wholly legitimate. It's about human flourishing. There are aspects of it that do pose a challenge or even a threat to us, and therefore we've gotten in the habit in Washington of speaking as though China's rise is somehow aimed at us. And of course, it's not at us in any sense. It's for them, as most Chinese experience it. So of course, not all Chinese. Elizabeth has very importantly pointed out the way that since Xi Jinping came to power, many Chinese have felt the increasingly heavy hand of the state, and people whose personal happiness depends on exercise what we would consider to be normal social and political freedoms have had a much more harder time of it, and some of them have been locked up. But I think for most Chinese, at least in my experience, they're still very happy to take the deal that the Chinese government has offered, that material life, technological life, continues to get better for most of them. And in a country that was so recently so desperately poor and so subject to so many kinds of violence and exploitation, both foreign and domestic, that's an enormous benefit. So there's a very important sense in which I think and hope that the answer to this question is yes. In another sense, if we look at this question, is this China's century, which of course evokes the phrase that was originated, I think, by Henry Luce, of America's century, that seems to be the implicit comparison here. Is China likely in the 21st century to have a global status similar to that the United States has enjoyed since the end of World War II? Then I think the answer is probably no. And the reason is that I agree with the official Chinese position that the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, while it evolves, will also endure. And I think there are a lot of reasons to believe that a China led by the CCP is going to prove continually unable to develop American-style soft power, which I should note is an asset that we are currently bleeding out at an alarming rate. So maybe it's, and I'll be interested to hear what the fellow speakers and all of you think, we should get around to answering this question. It may be neither country's century. Maybe it will be a more multilateral period, and the common challenge is going to be to achieve a stable balance. That may be a very good and desirable outcome. So we have entered a new era in U.S.-China relations. This was originally a Xiist phrase, Xin Shi Dai, the new era. And I think that it's merited. He and I would define it a little differently, but it's a merited phrase. And this new relationship between the United States and China is going to be characterized by long-term worldwide competition to shape global security architectures, trading regimes, technology development and regulation, a very important theme that this conference has properly stressed, norms and practices, as Elizabeth mentioned, and also value systems. This is a high-stakes contest, in other words, between two profoundly self-regarding and distrustful powers. That said, it's very important to note, I'm speaking at the political level. Can I see hands on people who've been to China? We haven't done this. It's usually a really good, okay, great, almost everybody. I can't see the students in the balcony, but those of you who haven't been, I hope you make it. When I say that we're involved in this high-stakes, distrustful competition, I don't mean to imply that the Chinese are in any way anti-American. It's not true. I think the opposite is true. You go there, and I think you'll find that they are marvelous hosts and interested in friendship and comparing experiences. This is not something that's true at the personal level, and I don't think that Americans are anti-Chinese, again, at the personal level either, so that when we can take some confidence in this. Nevertheless, it's a new era. And it's a new era in which I think there is a dearth of new ideas in both Washington and Beijing. I was at a conference last March in Beijing. There were two held on the same weekend. I don't know if Elizabeth, you went to one of these or not. But it was a well-intentioned conference in which a number of Americans who looked at China for a long time were invited to speak with Chinese counterparts who we've known for a long time, these people who know and, generally speaking, like and trust each other. And the question was, this relationship seems to be in steep decline. Does anyone have any ideas about how to keep it from going into free fall? The answer is no. Nobody had any ideas about this. We were stuck in mutual accusation. Both countries seemed pretty sure that most of the fault lay with the other, and that it was really a question of the other country waking up and smelling the coffee. When were you going to realize how this had to be handled? It was really quite discouraging. It is a joint failure of imagination that I think threatens our ability to manage this increasingly contentious relationship peacefully. So I just want to talk a little bit about this failure of ideas on both sides. China first. China, I think, as a nation, the polity, is more sure of its direction and its capabilities than is the United States. I'll come back to this in a minute. At the same time, I think there is a consistent failure and incapability from Chinese officialdom. And I want to keep, it's very hard to have these quick talks about China because we tend to use shorthands like China, the PRC, the CCP, and it sounds like we're always talking about all of the Chinese people. So an obvious disclaimer, obviously that's not true. China is vast and varied. There's a saying in Chinese, Lin zi da, shen men yao dou you. It's a big forest, it's got all kinds of birds. And that's true in China, it's true in the United States. So shorthand here, I beg your indulgence with that. So China's more sure of its direction, but seems to have a hard time conceiving of China as one country among many rather than as the Middle Kingdom. And what I mean by that is that in its quest for increased influence, soft power, what China calls discursive power, the ability to shape China's story worldwide, China to date has been really stymied, crippled by its insularity and by its very deep belief in Chinese particularism, or what Xi Jinping in particular calls the tusa. China has tusa, it's different, it's sui generis. This is why Xi Jinping rejects the idea of universal values. And in the Xiist description of China's greatness, it is this tusa, this essential and distinct Chinese-ness, which drives Chinese history and compels policy in certain directions. And because China is particularistic, critiques from the outside of China are perhaps not legitimate. There's a rejection of universalism and a belief in Chinese wisdom. And you hear an increased emphasis on this Chinese-ness in Xiist discourse, and it's not really working so well outside of China. Again, it is true that China is a civilization state, and that needs to be continually re-examined if we are to understand China and deal with it properly. And so I think that Martin Jakes is quite correct to stress China's status as a civilization state. And one of China's greatest strengths in competition with the United States is a commonality of purpose among many Chinese. Now, St. Augustine said that a nation should be defined as a multitude of rational beings in common agreement as to the objects of their love. That, I would say, is not an apt description of the United States. Right now, in China, there are disagreements, it's true, but there's a relatively strong buy-in, top to bottom, and sense of national project. It's continued increases in individual well-being, material and technological, first, and then I would say national status second. And people, Chinese, argue about individual policies and timetables and points of emphasis and all this stuff, but that sense of national project is strong. I'm not sure we have one. It's strong within China. But when China then wants to project those same sets of values and beliefs internationally, we have already seen, and Beijing has heard, a tremendous amount of global blowback to, I think, what is primarily Chinese Xiist overreach. And we are seeing blowback to the Belt and Road Initiative, even on China's doorstep, even to an extent in Pakistan, deep concerns in Kazakhstan, in Russia, in the Maldives, in Malaysia. I think that in the various critiques that we're hearing of Huawei, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole today, but no matter what you make of those critiques, it's a pushback against Chinese methods and Chinese practices, against these tusa. You see this in the debate about China's influence on American domestic institutions and communities. And this is a debate that is echoed in the Five Eyes nations in the UK, in Australia, in New Zealand, and Canada, and indeed in much of Western Europe. Again, pushback, blowback against Chinese methods. We saw this in the past year in which Chinese diplomats were accused of being sort of very brusque, declarative, and really bullying both in Papua New Guinea and Nauru. There's a blowback to the Chinese TUSA that we see going on around the world. So why is China behaving in this way? What is Chinese foreign policy about? My shorthand for this, and this is something that is in need of critique and commentary, so, you know, Wuxinbo, you can have at me in the Q&A. But I've come to understand Chinese foreign policy as seeking, one, a world that is highly integrated. China's quite sincere about this. This works out for China. A world that is highly integrated, but wholly accepting of Chinese prerogatives and practices. And so the question becomes, what is the nature of those prerogatives and practices? China, the CCP, treats its own people in a certain way. And as its power and influence and ambition spreads, it is able to treat, if you will, peoples in other nations in roughly the same way. And so one of the questions that we have to ask, regardless of all the many fine things that China has achieved, is do we want to live in a world that is increasingly amenable to an increasingly repressive at home and aggressive internationally CCP? In other words, when we think of Chinese governance or Chinese global leadership, our moral judgment, I think, is quite properly invoked. Okay, and even with all of the many things that we could say about American hypocrisy and misjudgment and arrogance and violence, and yes, I grant you everything. But the choice between Chinese values and American values broadly, which are fundamentally different as they concern the relationship between authority and the individual, the choice between these two modes of governance or modernities, this is not like the choice between chocolate and vanilla ice cream. Very real issues are at stake because of the nature of some of these Chinese practices that we've already discussed. And so the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, faces a dilemma as it tries to develop soft power. It believes strongly that because China is so vast and so complex, and because of its history, only an authoritarian, strong central state can provide the kind of stability that is necessary for continued development. That's the basic proposition, and it's a defensible proposition. But because of that, the Chinese government has become accustomed to communicating with its own people in a very top-down, harsh, declarative way. And so when it goes overseas and tries to develop discursive power or soft power, it speaks in the same way, and people don't like it, and people don't have to put up with it. But China's finding that it can't adjust. It can't speak harshly at home and softly overseas, what they call Neijin. Why? Because China's too open. 150 million Chinese people travel every year. They read the internet. The Chinese people would know, and they wouldn't put up with it. So it's a true dilemma for China. They can't adjust, and they've had a hard time building soft power and getting buy-in, which is why I think they're going to have a hard time exercising the kind of power they would like in the 21st century. So a dearth of new ideas, and these new ideas are badly needed. Kaiser, we spoke to the U.S.-China Strong student group last year, and Kaiser said something I think is very, very important, and it stayed with me since, that when we speak of U.S.-China relations, and this, you can correct me if I get the wording wrong, but the idea was that we have to contextualize that within the global history of ideas, intellectual history. And I think that's right. So we need to focus on the ideational side of the relationship. I think a failure of new ideas is all too obvious on the American side, where the idea seems to be a kind of retrenchment that alternates between a defensive crouch and a sort of flailing that is as demeaning as it is ineffectual internationally. And we heard this and stark display in Vice President Pence's October 4th, 2018 speech at the Hudson Institute, which was really a declaration of hostility to China. He said that China was a bad actor. It's a bad actor within its own borders. It's a bad actor internationally. It's a bad actor within the United States. And yet this was a litany of complaints that did not come close to comprising a strategy. And so a few questions that it seemed not to ask, and I'll go through these really quickly, but these were to me the glaring silences in what Pence said. And he went, it was a very threatening speech. It went from, okay, China, here's what we don't like about you, to, therefore, we are upgrading our nuclear arsenal. Well, there's no interpretation required here. It packed all together very closely. So the questions for America are things like, how much power do we still have? What costs are we willing to incur in this competition with China? Both how much can we afford, and how much are we willing to suffer? In the current trade frictions, there's a confidence in China that, yes, there's going to be deprivation in China and deprivation in the United States, but they're pretty sure that they're tougher than we are, that they can churku, eat more bitterness than we can, at least when it comes to things like soybeans. And I think they're probably right about that. There's also the moral question in this competition with China. How much harm are we willing to inflict? You know, this is, whether it's China, the PRC or not, this is still one-fifth of humankind. Is our policy going to be to harm their welfare in order to continually win? Another question that we have to address is, does our critique of China, and most of the things that Pence said, most of his criticisms, with a few exceptions, were correct, important, and long-standing. Nevertheless, it was primarily a litany of criticisms. And the problem I had with that is that his description of China doesn't come close to comprising China in its totality and in its complexity. And so, yes, we have an increasing, you know, surveillance state, which trends toward a kind of soft totalitarianism. We have all these problems in China that you've been hearing about, but if you go to China for the most part, you're not going to see people skulking in the streets. You know, the energy and the ambition comes up through the sidewalks. You can feel it. It's marvelous. It's impressive. And our legitimate complaints about China right now don't comprise that. And unless we have a China strategy that includes China in its totality and complexity, we can't succeed. One of the biggest questions, and this again comes back to this failure of ideas, and this is both a failure of China's part as well. Can either of these nations envision, do we have a practicable vision? And I mean a real vision, not Xi Jinping bromides, a community of common destiny, win-win situations. My mother used to refer to talk like this as, goodness is better than badness because it's nicer. It's just sort of this empty, bloviating language, one country, two systems. Do we have a practicable vision for stable relations between a powerful, prosperous US and a powerful, prosperous China? Can we get there? The challenge is to move beyond overreach on China's part and overreaction on America's part. I think what Kaiser called this ongoing freakout. And now, yes, we've recognized that this is going to be a contentious relationship. And I like that phrase better than competitive. I think competitive is a little too mild, adversarial is a little too strong. The challenge, I think, now is to normalize contentious relations, normalize competition, find a framework for it and a common understanding within which we can manage our enormous and high-stakes disagreement. I don't believe that this is a new Cold War. I reject that analogy. But if we think back to the Cold War for a minute, we had normalized competition. I don't like your face. I don't like your face either. Okay, well, let's sit down, and on that grounds, we know the limits of competition. We can compete when we must, we can cooperate when we must, and we were able to carry out things like arms control agreements because we had normalized competition. And that's the phase we need to enter into now. I think this is beginning to happen based on the writings I've seen from the scholarly community where an updated paper actually from the Asia Society, another paper by Hal Brands, Andrew Erickson. They're all trying to move beyond the freakout and define workable frames for this competition. So maybe we're getting there. I think the best way to normalize the relationship is to return to the traditional way of understanding the relationship, which is to get away from our fears and talk a little bit more clearly about American interests, limited bottom line interests vis-a-vis China. And I would say there are three. One, to prevent Chinese dominance of East Asia Pacific while recognizing that we cannot ourselves dominate, and while, as Xinbo mentioned, allowing is the wrong word because we don't really have a choice, but reframing increased Chinese influence. So dominance of the region, no. we must allow increased Chinese influence because we need to lower China's threat perceptions. Anything else is destabilizing. But China's dominance of the region would be very strongly harmful to the United States and its system of alliances, and that is an interest that is within our ability to carry out through our alliance systems. But again, no dominance, but recognize China's legitimate development of its military, its legitimate interests in the region. This calls on diplomacy. Number two, it's two of three interests, to prevent the global spread of illiberal Chinese practices. And again, here there's a big caveat, while acknowledging and welcoming China's increased ability to provide global public goods. And again, it is diplomacy that makes the difference between countering illiberalism and calling it out, and acknowledging and even encouraging China as a provider of global public goods. And again, this is within our ken. This is doable. And then lastly, and we're doing less well on this, we need to avoid a new arms race with China that will comprise not only nukes, but space and cyber as well. And this means, again, engagement, diplomacy. It means working through discussion mechanisms to build up new treaties and new understandings. We can do this. So against this background, U.S.-China relations, what are they? In my view, U.S.-China relations now are properly understood as a long-term historic dynamic, a structural dynamic. And what I mean is this contentious relationship is not primarily the fault of either one nation or the other. Some version of this was in the cards. It's a historic dynamic with a very long arc, in which, in my view, China must learn to be a truly integrated world power, despite its extremely deep civilizational instinct for insularity. And the United States must adjust to the fact of Chinese power, despite our preference for continued preeminence. And so if that or something like it is right, it means that to manage this relationship peacefully, both countries have to change in profound and difficult ways, and to a degree set aside their versions of exceptionalism. We both face very difficult choices in doing that. What we don't face, and this is something else that Washington doesn't understand, we have no choice about making a choice. A risen China is a truly epochal development, and it is going to change, transform the United States profoundly, no matter what decision we make. Attempting to ignore China or to wish it away will change us. Trying to oppose China at every turn will change us in another way. Accommodating China fully and doing exactly what Xi Jinping would like, that would certainly change us, and that's not my recommended course. And so I'm happy to subscribe to the four C's and go after them more closely with Elizabeth. I think that if both nations find ways to change over the very long term, then we can both find ways to prosper in this century, no matter who ends up claiming it. Thank you very much. Greatly enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today, you heard two speakers from the Camden Conference. Elizabeth Economy discussed the Xi vision, and Robert Daly presented U.S.-China relations, a new era in need of new ideas. They spoke at the recent 32nd Annual Camden Conference in Camden. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.